Good day. Today is Thursday, 28th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, yesterday I discussed in some detail the various warnings that the Russians had given to the United States and ultimately to the West about the presence of their diplomats in Kiev, the further signals that the Russians have been giving about increased strikes against Kiev. And I also discussed briefly, or touched on briefly, the long-term plans that the Russians, in my opinion, have, both to isolate the Ukrainian government and political leadership in Kiev, to sever its contacts with the West by basically obliging the West to pull its embassies and personnel out of Kiev, and the long-range plans that the Russians may have eventually to begin a siege of Kiev and to seek, not this year, but perhaps next year, to seek eventually to capture the city, which is, of course, the capital of Ukraine. Now, over the last few hours, reports have been circulating of a desperate, frantic letter sent to President Trump of the United States by President Zelensky of Ukraine. And this undoubtedly was the outcome of the massive Russian combined missile and drone strike on Kiev, which took place some days ago, the same strike over the course of which the Russians used an Oreshnik missile to attack a facility in a satellite town south of Kiev. And Zelensky, in this letter, the text of which, by the way, I have not read, apparently tells Trump about the urgent shortages of air defense missile interceptors in Ukraine, the fact that Ukraine is now extremely short of these missile interceptors, and he pleads with Trump to supply more Patriot missile interceptors to protect the skies over Kiev. In other words, the Ukrainians absolutely are taking these warnings from the Russians seriously. Zelensky himself most certainly does anticipate a succession of further Russian strikes against Kiev. And Zelensky, therefore, aware of the parlous state of Kiev's air defences, is now pleading with the Americans to put these air defences in order. Now, what, of course, Zelensky doesn't address is the underlying problem, which, by the way, has been increasingly manifest since last year, which is the general shortage of Patriot missile interceptors. I remember when the Biden administration first decided to supply a complete Patriot missile system, complete with radars and air defense missiles and the launch vehicles, back in the spring of 2023 to Ukraine, that it was at that time suggested that it would be a one-off, with acknowledgements even then that the Patriot system might not be fully effective against all the various different types of Russian missiles, and that there was already a general lack of these missiles, these Patriot missiles, because demand for them around the world was so high. Well, as it happens, Ukraine quickly ran through its stockpile of Patriot missile interceptors. And as night follows day, Zelensky came back and demanded more and more. And again, as night follows day, the Biden administration made sure that Zelensky was provided with more and more. And the Russians, of course, then began to hunt the Patriot systems in Ukraine. I can remember one particular day when the Russians caught two Patriot missile systems, batteries, radars, everything in fact, out in the open and destroyed them. But nonetheless, and despite that, President Biden and his officials continued to supply these missiles and these systems. And where the Americans led, the Europeans followed. Germany supplied several systems, as did the Netherlands. And these were systems that the United States had previously supplied to Germany and the Netherlands, but the Germans and the Dutch sent them to Ukraine. And gradually, the Patriot missile stockpile began to become increasingly depleted. And around the late spring of last year, reports began to appear that the Pentagon had made a decision that the situation with global stockpiles of Patriot missile interceptors had become so stressed that it would stop supplying more of these missile interceptors to Ukraine. And then again, as night follows day, Zelensky called Trump, pleaded with Trump to resume supplies. Zelensky's pleas were backed by the European leadership. Articles began to appear in the media in the West saying that the whole story about shortages of Patriot missile interceptors being in short supply was untrue, and that there was ample scope to continue to provide them to Ukraine. Something which was so obviously untrue, by the way, that I remember commenting about the fact at the time, and to be straightforward about it, it took my breath away. But anyway, surprise, surprise, Donald Trump acceded to Zelensky's request, and in the autumn of last year, more Patriot missile interceptors were indeed supplied, though I am not sure in what number. And of course, the Germans and the Europeans have continued to buy Patriot missile interceptors for Ukraine from the United States, further depleting the stockpile. And then on the 28th of February, the war between Iran and the United States began. And the United States took up the main burden of protecting Israel and the Middle Eastern, and the US's Middle Eastern allies from Iranian missile and drone strikes. And the number of Patriot missile interceptors used up to try to repel these attacks, without much success, by the way, depleted the stockpile still further. I was reading an article just this morning in the Daily Telegraph about how the entire stockpile of TAD missile interceptors has now been catastrophically depleted, and that the stockpile of standard missiles used by American warships have been depleted as well. This article in the Daily Telegraph avoids any mention of the situation with Patriot missile interceptors, but I've learned from various sources, which you can find all of them, by the way, beautifully summarised by Larry Johnson on his indispensable site, Sonar 21, I've learned that roughly half the stockpile of Patriot missile interceptors which existed on the 28th of February 2026 and was held by the United States, has now been lost. So the United States is now not just critically short of Patriot missile interceptors, it is disastrously short of Patriot missile interceptors. These systems are, of course, manufactured in the United States, but production is slow, the weapons are complicated and expensive to produce. Some parts of these systems are apparently handmade. The United States is going to have to focus probably for years ahead in building up its own stockpile. It simply doesn't have any of these missiles spare to give to Ukraine. And here there are other factors in play as well, because there are reports coming from the United States, and they appear to be reliable, and they have been confirmed by the German media magazine Der Spiegel, that the Pentagon anyway is planning to significantly reduce America's military footprint in Europe. Apparently, a third of the fighter jets are due to leave. More US ground troops will leave as well. The 5,000 troops that President Trump pulled out of Germany are going to be the first, but more will follow. US nuclear submarines will no longer be attached to NATO forces. There will be altogether a major redeployment of what is in fact a shrinking military, despite the enormous amounts that have been that are spent on it. The US military overall has steadily diminished in size since the end of the Cold War. But what of it there is going to be principally focused on confronting China in the Asia Pacific. The Europeans are going to be expected to take up the burden of their own conventional military defence. The United States will continue to provide the Europeans with a nuclear umbrella, but its forces, its conventional forces, are going to be less and less committed to the defence of Europe. And for the record, there are lots of reports about this appearing all over the European media, maybe not in the headlines, but European officials have been discussing this continuously with each other. There is growing alarm, but a growing awareness that the Americans are indeed not so slowly leaving. And this, by the way, plays an important role in understanding the extreme reactions of the Europeans to events that take place in Ukraine and their fear of a Russian victory there. Because the Americans are leaving and the Europeans are increasingly having to confront the possibility of having to face the Russians by themselves. Now, as many of you may know, I have a classical training. I can never forget how in the year 410, the Roman Emperor Honorius wrote to the British cities, telling them that he was withdrawing the Roman army from Britain. And from that moment on, the British cities needed to look after their own defence. That was the end of the Roman Empire in Britain. And in fact, in the case of Britain, it was the beginning of a long period known as the Dark Ages. Well, I don't think we are in the Dark Ages or facing the Dark Ages or anything like that. Quite the contrary, actually. But in some respects, this quiet announcement from the Americans that the moment, the time of their stay in Europe is coming to an end, you could say, is almost as consequential as the letter to the British cities penned long ago by the Roman Emperor, telling them henceforth to look after their own defence. Anyway, putting aside these classical allusions, the point here, again, is that with the Americans now gradually working towards an exit from Europe, to my mind, that suggests that they're going to be even less inclined to commit what reduced resources in the air defence field that they still have to supporting Ukraine by diverting urgently needed Patriot missile centres, interceptors, from where the US wants them in East Asia and to a certain extent the Middle East, by diverting them to Ukraine. And there is, of course, also a personal factor at play. I don't think it's much of a secret that President Trump and President Zelensky don't get on. The Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance, and President Zelensky had a major public row. I think that President Trump has long since come to the view that with respect to the United States, President Zelensky has acted a little like the Pied Piper, leading America away on paths that it should not have trod. So I don't think that this letter from President Zelensky begging for more Patriot missile interceptors from President Trump is going to do much good. If any Patriot missile interceptors come from the United States, which, by the way, I doubt, they will come in dribbles, nowhere near enough to make a difference. So where does that leave President Zelensky? Well, the short answer is he will turn to his European friends. And they still have some Patriot missile interceptors. Certainly Germany does. It has the German Defence Ministry, the German Defence Minister Boris Pistorius, have at various times told the Ukrainians that they simply cannot continue to give Ukraine Patriot missile interceptors out of their own stockpiles because those two are running short. But that, of course, ignores the overriding political imperative across Europe now to keep Ukraine in the battle. And in fact, the new defence commissioner of the European Union, what has he done? He has come forward and said that all European states must focus as their overriding priority on continuing to supply Ukraine with the weapons it needs so that it can continue its defence. So we are likely to see over the next few weeks and months, the Europeans, who of course are supposed to be rearming, but who are running into growing problems with their rearmament drive, which is spending vast amounts of money and which is not producing much in the way of armaments. Anyway, what we're going to see is that there's going to be a scramble across Europe to find Patriot missile interceptors so that these can be sent to Ukraine. And the pattern that we have seen throughout the whole history of the special military operation, going back to February 2022, is about to repeat itself with even greater force. The European allies are going to strip themselves of even more weapons to keep Ukraine. And Zelensky in the battle, even as they tell each other about the importance of rearming. And what's going to happen is that as quickly as they rearm, they will be disarming themselves, because they will send whatever new weapons they produce and whatever old weapons they still have as quickly as they can, as fast as they can, to Ukraine. And in the end, that will, of course, further pressure the whole rearmament drive in Europe and drive it into reverse. And I, for one, would not be surprised if in a few years' time, by 2030, we find that the Europeans have even fewer weapons in their inventories than they do now, even though many of them are saying that it is in around in 2030 that they must prepare for this Russian attack they're all frightening each other with. So anyway, that is what we're going to see. Notwithstanding which, let me repeat again, whatever Patriot missile interceptors or other air defence systems the Europeans now supply to Ukraine, and of course the Europeans do produce some air defence systems. There's the Aspid system, that is in very low rates of production and in very limited supply. There is the Iris-T system that the Germans produce, which has apparently not worked especially well. There is another system that the Norwegians, together with the Americans, also produce. But whatever systems these countries send to Ukraine, it is not going to be anywhere near enough. It's not going to be able to cope with the increased numbers of hypersonic missiles that the Russians are using and the fleets of drones the Russians are operating. And of course, it is absolutely impossible that any one of these systems could successfully counter a system like the Oreshnik. Zelensky, probably is blind to all of this, or perhaps he doesn't want to address it, but he has seen for himself how exposed Kiev now is to Russian missile and drone attacks, and his letter to Trump needs to be understood as a manifestation of panic and desperation. But whatever, he's not going to give up the war. He's not going to enter into negotiations with the Russians. I doubt that he himself is prepared to leave Kiev at the present time. When I mean leave Kiev, I don't mean go on his journeys around the world, but leave Kiev entirely, taking the government with him. So he's going to remain in Kiev, and he's going to be fearing about the fact that these missile and drone strikes are going to come. And he's going to know, deep down, he probably already knows, that the air defences have not only failed, but will continue to do so. Now, just to repeat a point that I made briefly in my programme yesterday, as the air defences fail, as the number of Patriot systems runs out, as the number of Iris-Ts and other systems also run out, it is highly likely that we're going to see the Russians use not just missiles and drones to attack targets in Kiev, but fighter jets and FAB bombs. And these bombs, which are precision guided and are gliding bombs and can therefore reach targets over considerable distances, carry massive explosive charges, far bigger than those of a drone, a ground drone, and bigger than those of a missile. And they can do tremendous damage. And, well, as I said, at some point over the next year, we're going to start to see them in use, I suspect, over Kiev as well. So, anyway, there it is. A confession from Zelensky about the desperate straits that Kiev and Ukraine are in with air defence. Desperate straits for which there is now no solution. And, of course, all of this after the Russians have given their warnings. Now, here perhaps it's important just to clarify a little what those warnings are. The Russians have never said that they were aiming for decapitation strikes or that they were planning to kill Zelensky himself. They talk about decision-making centres, and they've clarified again, and by the way, for the record, they have also said in the past that they mean command centres, places from which drones and missiles are launched and guided, and where the various command and intelligence staff work. Some of the buildings where this takes place will probably be bunkers, but the Russians themselves have now provided some information about what they claim is the ability of the Oreshnik to destroy underground structures. Now, this has been a very controversial topic. You have people like Professor Postol, who have pointed out that the hypersonic nature of the warheads the Oreshnik uses means that they are not able to penetrate far below the surface. Others have said, however, that the impact of these hypersonic warheads must cause massive surface vibrations, which would indeed do great damage to underground structures like bunkers. Well, we now have certain comments from a Russian official, Alexander Stepanov, a military expert at the Institute of Law and National Security at the Russian Presidential Academy of National Economy and Public Administration. Now that is, by the way, reports directly to Putin himself. So person, Stepanov, said this: a new mechanism for eliminating the military-industrial complex has been activated. And here, by the way, it's necessary to note the role of the Oreshnik missile system, given the assessed capabilities of its kinetic potential for destroying underground industrial infrastructure. This is truly what is capable of penetrating these numerous Soviet-era engineering legacy sites, which now house the main assembly shops and storage facilities for components for the Ukrainian attack and reconnaissance drones, as well as Flamingo-type missiles. And then Stepanov pointed out that Kiev's airspace is covered by Western air defence systems, including the Patriot, which, however, do not react to hypersonic weapons in any way, as they simply do not have the appropriate tactical and technical characteristics to intercept such targets. Combat testing allows us to refine the tactics of using these systems, demonstrates their real effectiveness in combat conditions, and in the long term, projects a similar impact on those NATO countries that sponsor the Kiev regime and provide military technical support to the Ukrainian armed forces and other force structures that plan and carry out attacks against peaceful regions of the Russian Federation. And in effect, what he's saying is that this is a message to the West. If it continues the line of escalation with military technical support for attacks against Russian civilian targets, even the deep military infrastructure will not help them, and their command centers will be eliminated for sure, if only with the use of intermediate range missile systems. So what Stepanov is saying here is that, yes, the Oreshnik can conduct strikes. So what Stepanov is saying here is that, yes, the Oreshnik can indeed destroy underground structures, specifically the industrial structures created by the Soviet Union beneath its main armament factories, structures like the network of tunnels and underground facilities that we saw under the Azovstal steelworks in Mariupol, and which are known to exist or were known to exist under the Yuzhmash plant in Dnipro. Yes, the Oreshnik can destroy these sort of structures. In fact, it was specifically designed with that end in mind. He says that it has been an assessed capability. So that appears to imply that the Russians have conducted tests of the Oreshnik system, presumably within Russia itself, establishing that it does indeed have the capability to destroy facilities located underground beneath factories. And the Russians obviously can now use that capability that the Oreshnik provides them to conduct attacks to destroy underground industrial facilities in Ukraine. That the more they do this, the more frequently they do this, the more understanding and skill they will acquire in how to do this. In other words, they will learn from experience and will be able to refine their tactics and conduct whatever further improvements to the system that it requires. And though the Oreshnik seems to be mostly designed to attack underground structures located beneath factories, it can be used against underground bunkers designed to operate as command centers. And over time, that capability will further develop and increase, possibly as new weapons based on the experience of using the Oreshnik come into production. And importantly, Stepanov is also telling us that the attacks using the Oreshnik, which have been taking place in Ukraine, are also a warning to the West as well. There's been a massive amount of speculation about whether the Russians have any plans to conduct strikes at factories and industrial plants and maybe even military bases across the West, across Western Europe, or at least NATO Europe, which are involved in supporting the Ukrainian war effort. Well, Stepanov doesn't say that this is indeed going to happen, but he says that the use of the Oreshnik in Ukraine ought to serve as a warning to the NATO powers that the Russians do indeed have that capability, and that it might be unwise for the NATO powers to assume that the Russians will never use it. Perhaps the day may come when they might, in fact, actually do so. And here again, Stepanov also says that in that case, the Russians are likely to come after the NATO command bunkers as well. And I've heard informally, and I stress informally because I have no information about this, and I suspect that this is a deeply classified matter. So when I say I've heard informally, I want to stress this is not from any official source, but I've heard informally that one of the differences is that command bunkers in Western Europe are located at far less deep underground than the Soviet era command bunkers, which were created across the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Those were built far deeper, and perhaps that means that the ones in the West, which are much closer to the surface, are indeed more vulnerable to attacks than from the Oreshnik, than the very deep Soviet command bunkers might be. Now, again, I want to stress this is not based on any classified information. I suspect that information is deeply classified. I don't possess it. It's just what I've been told, and I'm not vouching for the person who told me this having any great depth of information about it, though he does appear to me to be somebody who does generally know what he's talking about. Anyway, there it is. That is what Stepanov said, and that's the kind of capability that the Russians possess. So, what the Russians have said about their campaign against Kiev is that they're not going to try to obliterate the whole city. They're not aiming to murder the entire Ukrainian leadership in the way that the United States and Israel have murdered the leadership of Iran. That's not what the Russian objective at the present time is. The Russian objective is to go after the command centers, some of which are probably located underground in these very same industrial facilities, using the kind of underground structures that exist beneath Soviet era factories. The Russians are going to come after those, and they know where they are. And the Russians are going to go after those industrial facilities in Kiev, which produce the drones and the missiles and other weapons, facilities beneath the Artyom plant, for example, in Kiev, and probably in other places in and around Kiev too. And the Russians, for the moment, are saying that that is what they're going to do. And if there are any Western engineers or technicians or military officials or intelligence officers in those bunkers and in those underground factories from the West assisting Ukraine in their war effort, then they are now on notice that when the attacks come, they're likely to be killed, and it is not a matter of concern to the Russians if they are. Now, on other matters, again, it's important to say that the Russians have never said that they're going to actually attack Western embassies in Kiev. What they have said is that given the type of attacks that are now going to start happening in Kiev, Western embassies would be well advised to leave, because some of their embassy facilities, many of their embassy facilities, are located very close to these structures that the Russians are going to attack. If we're talking about strikes using the Oreshnik, well, the ground vibrations might in themselves do significant damage to nearby buildings, including embassies. And for their own safety, it would be a good idea for the West to leave. As I described it in a previous video, it was advice. It was telling the West, take your people out of Kiev. We're not coming to kill them, but if you keep them where they are, be prepared for the fact that many of them are going to die. Now, the point here is that a direct attack on an embassy is an attack on the sovereign territory of the country whose embassy it is, and it can be treated as an act of war. And intentional killing of diplomats, well, that is a major violation of international law. Diplomats are protected by all the various conventions, and intentionally hunting down and killing diplomats can be construed as an act of war as well. I think it is inconceivable that the Russians will deliberately target embassies. The Russians are particularly sensitive to this issue because their embassies have come under regular attacks ever since the Russian Revolution. And they, for that reason, are sticklers behind the laws, supporting the laws that protect embassy premises and diplomats, because they know perfectly well that if they start to break these laws, their many opponents in the West will do the same to them. So, by way of illustration, in 2016, the end of 2016, just a few weeks before he ceased to be President of the United States, President Barack Obama, illegally, as the Russians would say, ordered the seizure across the United States of Russian diplomatic premises. The Russians have vociferously complained about this ever since. The pretext it was done was Russiagate, which turned out to be a completely bogus theory of collusion between the Russians and Donald Trump. The Russians have demanded the return of their diplomatic buildings. And, well, that's just one example of how Russian embassies around the world, but especially in the West, constantly come under harassment and pressure. I could come up with many, many other examples. So the Russians will not want to create precedents that could be used against them by going after diplomats and going after embassies. And that's over and above and beyond the fact that I can't imagine someone like Putin ever consenting to do this sort of thing. But the point is that what the Russians are doing is that they're telling the West, for your own health, stay away, go away. That means that if any diplomats are killed or if diplomatic premises are damaged, the Russians can legitimately say that they gave fair warning. And the Russians, anyway, as I discussed at length in my video yesterday and in a follow-up post that I published on X and which you can also read on our Substack site, anyway, for political reasons, want the West to leave Kiev, isolating Zelensky and leaving him on his own. Now, as for Zelensky himself, I don't think the Russians have as yet any plans to come after him. There was an attack a few days ago on a building that housed an apartment of Zelensky's, but the word in Ukraine is that this was debris, perhaps from falling air defense missiles that crashed back on Earth. There's actually pictures of a Patriot missile interceptor that failed to intercept any incoming Russian missiles or drones crashing into an apartment building in Kiev during the big attack that took place a few days ago. So I suspect that that was what it was. Anyway, Zelensky wasn't there. I doubt that the Russians were in fact trying to kill him in that apartment building. From a Russian point of view, as Putin has many times pointed out, Zelensky is the gift that goes on giving. He makes eccentric and irrational command decisions. He's created a rupture in relations between Ukraine and the United States by rejecting American proposals, which might have brought the war to an end in ways that many people in Russia would consider unsatisfactory. It is in Russia's political interests for him to remain alive and in control of Ukraine so that the Russians can continue with their special military operation and complete it and achieve all the objectives that they have in the meantime set themselves. So I don't believe the Russians are going to go after Zelensky, though I doubt that he himself is fully sure about this. But anyway, that's what I think the Russians are going to do. Now, in the hours that followed, all Western governments and the European Union insisted that embassies will remain in Kiev. This is what I predicted would happen, what I said would happen in my program yesterday. Bizarrely, doing something which I suspect exposes her feelings about the Americans, Kaya Kallas made what turned out to be a false claim that the Americans were closing their embassy in Kiev and were withdrawing from Kiev. The US contradicted that claim, as did the Ukrainian authorities. And I suspect that the fact that it was Kaya Kallas who repeated this story is going to make the Americans even more angry with her than they already are. It's worth pointing out that the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, doesn't even want to meet with her. And this latest example of what she gets up to is going to make the Americans more angry with her still. As a matter of fact, Yuri Ushakov, Putin's foreign policy aide, commented on Kaya Kallas's claim that the Americans were quitting Kiev. Ushakov said that one shouldn't pay much attention to what Kaya Kallas says. He didn't believe that this was, in fact, what the Americans at the moment were intending to do. I believe that as the Russian missile and drone offensive in Ukraine against Kiev starts to crank up, eventually we will indeed see the embassies leave and the Westerners leave, as I discussed in my program yesterday. Now, as to when the next attack will come, I don't know. And Peskov, Putin's spokesman, was asked about it, and he didn't say much about it either, and nor did Ushakov. A Russian MP has said that there's no plan to attack Bankovo, the building which houses Zelensky. As I just said, the Russians don't have any plans, as far as I know, to kill Zelensky. And the same Russian MP said that the Russians have no plan to attack the Ukrainian Parliament building. And that also makes sense, because some of the people in the Parliament are probably people that the Russians one day might want to talk to when the major crisis in Ukraine comes. But an attack from the Russians will happen. Ushakov and Peskov confirmed as much in their comments. It's going to be a prolonged offensive against Kiev, which will intensify over the months, and which I believe at some point next year is going to escalate to a full ground offensive against that city. Well, there it is. Now, in the meantime, the war itself on the ground goes on. And there's a very interesting article, by the way, about this, about the state of the war in the Financial Times. Again, repeating the story that the tide in the war has turned in Ukraine's favour. When you go through the article, and all the articles, by the way, that say this, as I have noticed, are very, very careful not to provide any actual details about what is actually happening on the front lines. But anyway, this article, if you drill through it carefully, actually admitted that, in fact, even though the tide is supposed to be turning in the Ukrainians' favour, it is the Russians who are still advancing. Now, all I will say about that is that it is commentators in the West who have up to now insisted that in measuring progress in the war, territory doesn't matter, capture of territory doesn't actually... It is commentators in the West who have insisted that captures of territory are the main criterion of success. It's those of us who've argued that it is about attrition who say that territory matters less. Well, here we see the Financial Times flipping over. They're now saying that actually the fact that the Russians are advancing is less important. It's the number of combat losses that really matters, not the amount of territory that is lost. Well, they're probably saying that because, in fact, more territory is being lost. Now, yesterday I discussed the situation in Zaporozhye following the Russian capture of Vozdvizhevka in eastern Ukraine. There's been some discussions about a Russian general staff map from the 9th of April, which purports to show around 40% of the town of Orekhov under Russian control. This is the southern part of Orekhov. I remember some weeks ago that General Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces and the Russian commander in chief, actually said that street fighting was taking place in Orekhov. I am not sure what to make of this map, and I have to say this straight away. And just as I wasn't sure what to make of Gerasimov's claim, I have seen no video footage of actual street fighting taking place in Orekhov. And I would have thought that if so much of the town had at any previous time indeed been under Russian control, we would know more about it. My guess is that this was, again, a exercise by the Russians in creating confusion amongst the Ukrainians, focusing again attention on Orekhov, telling us that Orekhov is indeed the next target for the Russians, but giving the misleading impression that the danger to Orekhov comes from the south, when if you look at the situation on the front lines, it clearly mostly comes from the east. Anyway, I'm not going to pay much attention to this map, about whose provenance I'm not, by the way, entirely sure. But elsewhere, we do have much more definite information about what is happening in Konstantinovka. I'm going to revise my view that the Russians control 30 to 40% of the town. I think it's higher than that. I believe that the fight for Konstantinovka is now definitely in its final weeks. And Khairulin said that the situation for the Ukrainians who are still fighting in Konstantinovka is now completely desperate, and that the Russians have them basically surrounded in many places. Anyway, there it is. The ground offensive continues. Konstantinovka is going to fall. Probably Liman is going to fall fairly soon also. That will then leave Slavyansk and Kramatorsk isolated, potentially surrounded, and then the last stage of the battle of Donbass will begin. And in the meantime, with every passing day, more reports trickle through of further territory occupied by the Russians in Sumy region and in Kharkiv region. I use the word occupied rather than captured, because I get the sense that in many cases, the Russians simply walk into villages that are mostly undefended. As I said in previous programs, what seems to me to be happening in northeastern Ukraine is that the Russians are building a staging area there, and the ultimate objective, probably, is to prepare the ground for an attack on Kiev. I'm going to finish this roundup by saying, firstly, a bit more about the Russian build-up in Belarus. My source, who provides me information from the Duma, says that the chatter there is that the Russians at the moment have no immediate plan to advance on Kiev from the north, but they're perfectly happy to let the Ukrainians think that they do, and that what that does in the meantime is that it ties down significant Ukrainian forces on the Belarus border at a time when the Ukrainian army overall is desperately overstretched. And this same source told me that the Russians are now preparing another offensive in northeastern Ukraine, this time from Bryansk region. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. Now, lastly, and far from least, two more Russian officials have now come out and spoken about the European Union having ceased to be an economic association and having become a military political alliance which targets Russia. One of them is the Russian intelligence chief, Sergei Naryshkin, the head of Russian foreign intelligence, in a major report that he has published and which is being extensively discussed in the media, the Russian media this morning. And the other is Sergei Shoigu, the former Russian defense minister, who is now secretary of the Russian Security Council, and who can therefore be described as Putin's national security advisor. Shoigu also says that the European Union is now no longer just an economic association, but a political military alliance that is hostile to Russia. So we've had identical statements about the EU being a political military alliance from Lavrov, from Shoigu, from Medvedev, and from Naryshkin. All four senior members of Russia's Security Council. To my mind, this makes it certainty that at some point over the next few weeks, the Russians will confirm that they no longer agree to Ukraine after the war joining the European Union. The Russians have already said that the EU is as hostile and as dangerous to them as NATO itself. They oppose Ukraine entering NATO because it is opposed and dangerous to themselves. Is they're also saying that the EU is as opposed and as dangerous as NATO is. I can't see how they can continue to agree, as they have previously done, to Ukraine joining NATO. The only person who has not directly spoken on this subject is Vladimir Putin himself. And as I discussed a couple of programs ago, and in a post on X, published after his press conference on the 9th of May, Putin's feelings about the Europeans are now filled with bitterness and a sense of betrayal. And I don't think myself that he's any more keen on Ukraine joining NATO than any of the other Security Council members whom I have just listed. So there it is. I think that we are almost now at that point where the Russians are going to confirm this formally and publicly. Well, that is my roundup of the situation in Ukraine. I've heard many reports that the event in Starobelsk and that the Ukrainian drone attacks have darkened and hardened the mood, the popular mood in Russia, the demands directed at the Kremlin to press on to the total defeat of Ukraine are intensifying, and that these come with demands for an acceleration of military operations. I think that people who believe that the Russians are going to change course here are wrong. I don't believe that Putin himself is any different in his feelings on any of these questions than the majority of Russians. And I do think that from this point, we're going to see an increased tempo in the war. And as for the constant hopes in the West that economic conditions in Russia are going to suddenly deteriorate, we've had another spectacular example in the Financial Times today about the cherry picking that takes place in discussing economic news from Russia. So over the last few weeks, the ruble has strengthened significantly. It now is trading at around 70 to 71 rubles to the dollar, well below the 80 to 90 rubles to the dollar, which I suspect the economics ministry would prefer. The Financial Times points out that this is something that many business people in Russia are unhappy about, because it has reduced the competitiveness of their exports, which is true, by the way. And the Financial Times correctly says that one of the reasons for the strength of the ruble is the strong situation with Russian exports and Russia's large current account surplus, which, however, supposedly is causing problems through the high ruble for the Russian economy. Now, I'm going to just make two very quick observations here. Whilst the size of the current account surplus is indeed one of the reasons why the ruble is so strong, the main reason why the ruble is so strong is because interest rates in Russia continue to be so high. With real interest rates at 10%, it is economically profitable to keep one's money in rubles and to keep those rubles in a Russian bank where they are collecting this very high interest. And that means that fewer rubles are being converted into other currencies. And that is the real reason why the ruble is so strong, as those currencies are converted instead into rubles to benefit from the high interest rates. I say this because I noticed that the entire article in the Financial Times never mentions the high interest rates in Russia once. Just saying. The second thing about this article is that, of course, it talks about Russia running a big current account surplus. What he doesn't mention is that the whole point of Western sanctions policy has been to turn that surplus into a deficit so that the government in Moscow would supposedly run out of money. When one talks about a current account surplus, what one actually means is that money in the form of receipts from exports, oil and gas mainly, are pouring into Russia at such a high rate that they are causing the ruble to strengthen. So attempts to reduce Russian exports of oil and gas by harassing ships, by planting mines in ships, which the Russians have now discovered has been taking place. It turns out that ships, which had previously been assumed to have been attacked by drones, probably had magnetic mines planted in them, or in some cases, actual explosive devices smuggled inside them whilst they were in Western ports. A very interesting thing, which requires further discussion in a future video, just saying. Anyway, despite all of that, despite attacks on refineries at places like Tuapse, despite all the attempts to restrict Russian exports are not being restricted, they are booming. And that is creating a current account surplus. So far from Russia running out of money, money is pouring into the country, more than enough for the Russians, for the Russian government to keep spending on the war. Just saying. So I just mentioned these things because, again, it's extraordinary how much cherry picking about the data there is. When the ruble weakens, it's a sign of crisis in Russia. When the ruble strengthens, it's a sign of crisis with Russia. Anything that happens, apparently, is a sign of economic crisis in Russia. If there is a current account deficit, which there has never been, by the way, in recent times, that obviously is proof that the government is running out of money. If there is a current account surplus, that's causing the ruble to go up, which is causing a crisis for the economy and which is hurting exporters. There is never any admission, any recognition that the overall situation in the economy is stable. Well, this ends my discussion of the situation in Ukraine. Now, we also, of course, have the ongoing crisis with Iran. And a couple of days ago, I expressed my skepticism about the various hopes that the United States and Iran were indeed close to an agreement. And it turns out that they were not. President Trump himself, who at one time was talking up the possibility of an agreement, now furiously says that all Iranian claims about what was in the memorandum of understanding are untrue. He insists that Iran must simply hand over its entire uranium stockpile to the United States and to no one else, that it must scrap its entire uranium enrichment program. And he goes further and he says that the United States is not willing or prepared to give back anything in return. There'll be no sanctions relief at all. No release, apparently, of frozen assets to Iran. He has repeated on the uranium enrichment issue the same maximalist demands as always. And, well, that, of course, has been combined by further threats, including an especially strange one to blow Oman to smithereens and blow up Iran to smithereens if it doesn't do what the United States wants. I mean, quite what the president is thinking by making a threat like this against what has up to now been a friendly country, I simply don't understand. But anyway, on the back of all of these threats, it looks as if there was another American attempt to try to get tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranians blocked the entire operation using drones, so that the tankers all turned back. The United States then retaliated by conducting air and missile strikes against some Iranian military facilities, and the Iranians have countered by conducting strikes against an American military base. So it doesn't look quite like the total collapse of the ceasefire, but it does show that the United States and Iran are as far away from an agreement as ever. I have never in my time been as frustrated by a situation as I am by this one. To repeat again what I have pointed out so many times, but which I am tired of pointing out, there is a potential deal on the table which meets, satisfies everybody's core concerns and interests. The Iranians say they don't want nuclear weapons, but they do say they want to enrich uranium. They have made offers about how to regulate that enrichment program so as to ensure that they never acquire a nuclear weapons capability. And as to the stockpile, they are prepared to do various things with it, such as dilute it or place it under external supervision, but they cannot be expected, and it is unreasonable to demand of them that they hand it over to the United States, an unbelievably humiliating thing to do, which the Iranians are absolutely not going to do, when they are, as they believe, rightly, in a position of advantage. If America's concern, as it says or pretends, is to stop Iran acquiring a nuclear weapons capability, a totally satisfactory deal is there, and one which would lead eventually to the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. Perhaps if the thing was negotiated wisely, taking us back to the arrangements which existed before the 28th of February. We could, of course, have had this very deal without that attack on the 28th of February having taken place at all. The proposals were already there on the table. The refusal to take them, the obsessive insistence on somehow humiliating Iran and ultimately achieving regime change in Iran, which it ought to be obvious by now, are in practical terms beyond reach. However, continue to be insisted upon by a whole deluded army of people, ranging all the way from Prime Minister Netanyahu to the phalanx of neocons that control the foreign policy of the United States. So a perfectly viable deal, one which, as I said, meets all the United States' legitimate concerns, as a result, cannot be agreed, and we have this standoff in the Strait of Hormuz, even as the situation in the global economy continues to deteriorate. Sooner or later, things are going to get really bad, and then who knows what an increasingly desperate president is going to, at that point, do. In the meantime, he truly is caught between a rock and a hard place, though one shouldn't expend too much sympathy on him, because it was he himself who manoeuvred himself into that very position. But anyway, there it is. There is an escape route. It would cause him a certain degree of political damage. He would lose face in the United States, and he might rupture his relations with the neocons. But the neocons have never been his friends. The counsel they have given him, and by the way, all the preceding presidents, going all the way back to Bill Clinton, has been consistently bad and disastrously wrong. In my opinion, this president, the president we have now, Donald Trump, should not be sorry if there is a rupture with the neocons. He should welcome it, and he would quickly find that in that he has the support of the American people. But I say all of these things. I, of course, am talking into the air, because Donald Trump certainly doesn't listen to my programs. He listens instead to people like Netanyahu and Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz. And the result is that we are where we are. At some point, this intolerable, unstable equilibrium we're seeing in the Middle East is going to tip over. We are going to see some kind of return to war. It might be brief, it might be violent. I still can't imagine this president really does want a prolonged war with Iran, just saying. But, well, whatever, unless he grasps the nettle, does the deal with the Iranians, which, as I said, is objectively a good one, and which, with skillful negotiation and by talking intelligently to people like the Chinese, the Russians and the Saudis, might even be improved further. Unless he does that thing, well, we're going to get ourselves into this terrible situation in a few months' time, which will be bad for all of us, including, by the way, the United States, and of course for the president as well. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Don't forget that there is a major promotion on our shop taking place. And last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.